Hello, and welcome to Let It Dinner Green Team, where we talk about speculative fiction. My name is Hiran Fan, and I'm joined by my ever-present cancer cells, Ashimon.
Hi, everybody.
Today, we're going to talk about the notoriously frustrating book Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace, but only the first fourth up to the conversation with Hal and Oren, where Hal is clipping his toenails. So, first impressions. No spoilers. We could spoil this book.
This really feels like one of the ones where it's kind of impossible to really spoil. Like, I don't think the reading experience is going to be harmed at all by knowing the plot. What little there is of it.
I think you'd be surprised.
You think so? Okay.
Well, just go on.
Yeah. It's very clearly well written. I think that is basically inarguable. Like, David Foster Wallace knew what he was doing. He is executing what he wants to do, I think, very well. The prose is phenomenal. The characters, such as they are well written and well executed. And there is strong theming that is consistently reinforced and explored in different ways. And there is a resonance between characters and whatnot. But that being said, it is hard to read. It's just, there's so much to get through. There is so, and this is intentional, I think. There is at times such an overwhelming amount of like intense detail to the narration, and it wanders a lot, and it sometimes fails to focus on the things that are actually interesting. And there is a lot of absurdity, some of which I think is genuinely quite funny, and some of which I am rolling my eyes at, and some of which is genuinely insightful. So I have, like, I'm not regretting that I'm reading this book. It feels like a job to read at this point.
Glowing praise. Actually, I can't disagree with any of it, and that's coming as somebody. I should probably tell the listeners, this is my third time reading this. The first time I read it on an ebook, and the second time I listened to a podcast called Infinite Cast, where it's just someone's reading it to their boyfriend or husband or something, and they talk about it after every episode. And like, this is easily one of my favorite books of all time. But like, I think Ash is completely right. Although I think I probably enjoy it more than you did, and I imagined a lot of places where you say you rolled your eyes, I still thought was hilarious. Actually, I'm positive I did, because that's what
we've been having small chats about it on the server.
But especially looking back on my first read, it took me a really, really long time to finish this book, and that's because like it really kind of felt like a chore.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's intentional. Like, I think Wallace wants you to work hard reading this book. There's one thing I'm going to disagree with you though, because you said it was difficult to read.
Mm-hmm.
And you're correct in many, many ways. It is very difficult to read, but I'm going to disagree with one aspect where people sometimes mistake this. On a line to line level, it's actually incredibly clear in most places.
Yes. Yes.
Like, it's very, very accessible and very readable, especially if we're outside the situations, or especially when we're inside the tennis academy, because that has a very, very clear, very direct, not a lot of ambiguity involved in what they're saying and what they're trying to get across, especially Hal's point of views. But that's just what Hal is like.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the drug addicts sections, I would never ever describe in any situation as easy to read, especially the AAVE sections. But yeah, so yeah, those are my feelings the first time through. It was a chore. I think around, I want to say halfway through the book my first time, like I couldn't put it down, but it had taken me months to get to that point. So
yeah,
I'm curious how you will develop as we go on as well.
How long have we been reading that this time? Like, has it been a month or 2 months?
I don't think it's been 2 months. I could check my starve date, because I think I only started a few days after you did. I've been pretty consistent, so I think you've been going in spurts, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, it's been almost exactly a month. Maybe a month and a week.
Well, that It feels like it's been longer. And I'm trying to keep things in perspective, of course.
Book. Have you ever spent 4 months on one book?
4 months? Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You're still in your Ulysses, aren't you?
Well, yeah. Ulysses got put on hold because of this. But yes, I put books on extended holds. I guess continuous reading. I probably haven't done a book over 4 months. A certain history book called The Age of Napoleon by Will and Ariel Durant. That one took me a couple months, though. There are a lot of books that I've kind of put on hold and haven't returned to yet. That has been longer than that. But yes, I'm hoping, I'm cautiously optimistic that at some point during the reading process, I'll get sucked in. And I'll say that the beginning, I think, was really easy for me to read because I was drawn in by some of the stories there. And then lately, I think it's been easier to read as well. And there was kind of a lull in towards the middle where it kind of felt grueling. But
it doesn't feel like it, but there's a lot of setup in the beginning of this book.
Yes. I mean, yes. Yeah, it did feel like there was a lot of setup to me.
Well, I think... What you said is it felt like just a bunch of short stories, and it is. It does feel like that. And like I think literally a lot of these could be published as short stories because you don't need the greater context allowed. If you have the greater context of the world and you're following the narrative that this book does have, and it does have a narrative, then you'll pick up those pieces. But at the same time, you're learning, you're getting little snippets of these people's lives. And there is a beginning, middle, and end for most of these little short stories. That doesn't mean that it's an end to their story or that you won't see them again. For most, you actually will see again. But yeah, they're short stories.
And something that... Okay, so I appreciate that David Foster Wallace was concerned about people not being able to pay attention to things, to vapidity, to kind of a loss of any sense of purpose or... shortening attention spans. I think that this book does a great job of displaying that, and then conversely requiring a very focused attention to get through. Kind of like he's really making the point that yes, it is harder to focus now, and maybe this book will train you to focus better. But
speaking of that training, shall we talk about the end notes?
God, yeah. let's get into the end notes. Go ahead.
Okay, so the end notes, I think, for most readers are a source of infinite frustration. And I think any reader at any point will feel frustrated with these end notes. But at the same time, I think their inclusion, like just the inclusion of the end notes, I think is a fantastic joke in itself. And that when I was first reading this book, just having to flip back and forth from the beginning to the end of the book every page or so, like I was all smiles just because I thought it was hilarious. Not to mention that a lot of these footnotes they have no substance. Like it's
yes.
Every single drug that's mentioned in this book has a footnote explaining probably it's more proper terms. those are I hate those ones. Those are so bad. But at the same time, like they sometimes have really, really, really funny extended footnotes filled with lots of really good anecdotes or just greater context for the world that makes it feel real, and it rounds out the picture a lot better, if that makes sense. Because we learn about their I'm trying to think of a really good endnote right now. One I hated my first time, but I loved the second time. I shouldn't say hated it, because like I just didn't get it as much. Was the longest footnote I think we got was the long list of JOI's filmography.
Yes.
And in there are a lot of tiny jokes that you will probably miss the first time. Even on your first time, though, there are some quite entertaining movie descriptions.
Yes, yes, I appreciate that.
Sound hilarious.
Yes.
But at the same time, you could find little things inside the casts or I think the types of lenses he's using or how many times he abandoned project and went back to it. It gave you a feel for the kind of things that he's going for. And then, I don't know if you noticed this, like this is a bit of a tangent, but... a lot of things that happened in JOI's life were put on film in one of his films.
Oh, interesting.
Well, do you remember the section where he's pretending to be a conversationalist to talk to Hal?
Yes.
He made a movie about that. Or he made a film cartridge about that.
And
there's
see.
There's like, a few of them like that.
It's like Abed from Community.
Yeah. But like a really, really film. Pretentious, really art house stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, the end notes, I like David Foster Wallace is playing a joke on the reader at the reader's expense.
I agree.
Yes.
But like
sometimes I'm able
like
to laugh
me,
long.
I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes it will laugh long and say, oh, yeah, David, that is pretty funny. Ha ha. You got me. And then sometimes I'm like, David,
let me get back to the narrative.
People should be able to enjoy a book, you goddamn idiot.
I was enjoying this little story you gave. Why am I in the back of the book right now? Oh, I was thinking one. What was Pemulus? Maybe it was Trolch. I think it was Pemulus. He was translating a story, translating an article from French into English for one of his classes about the wheelchair assassins. Hmm. Do you remember this footnote?
No.
Oh.
There are good chances I skipped it.
Maybe it wasn't a footnote. It was really good, though. But what he does is he's trying to cheat by copying somebody else's work, but at the same time, he's putting tons and tons of work into making this translation, and then he's writing it, he's overwriting it like David Foster Wallace likes to overwrite things like he does in this book, and then he's complaining about it while also enjoying like writing it in the first place.
Very
it's
meta.
It's very meta. It's very masturbatory. But like this whole, we joke before that this book is masturbatory. It is. And number one reason, the whole Canada, Mexico, American Alliance is called ONAN or Onan, which is another biblical joke about masturbation.
That's funny. Yeah, I can only imagine that David Foster Wallace and Diogenes would have gotten along very well together. Yeah, I'm reading on ebook, so I just need to like click the end note and it just kind of pops up in a little box. Even that's too much for me sometimes. It's like a lot of the times it's like, okay, reading something, I'm trying to follow along. Oh, look, there's a footnote. Let me break my reading immersion just a little bit to read this footnote. Sometimes the footnote is like three words, like, okay, the Boston Police Department. Thank you, David. That was such a good footnote for you to add. And
there's
then sometimes
so many acronyms and initialisms.
Yeah. Yeah, and then sometimes it's like just a wall of text appears on the screen, and I just
pages. There are endnotes that are longer than the chapter that it's referenced in. The first time I found that, I thought that was one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
I just like, oh god, more work now. Oh, and then sometimes it's like, okay, I really appreciate this footnote. I like what it adds to the story. I think for the most part. There is, like, he's justified in using them for what he uses them for. I still want to punch him.
shall we talk about the story or the characters or the themes?
Yeah, I guess we never really gave a spoiler warning. I don't think anything we've said so far has been a spoiler.
Nothing we've said so far is a spoiler. Yeah. How would you describe this book to somebody like so far?
How would I describe it?
Somebody who might be interested.
Who comes up to me and says, I might be interested in reading Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Please give me a recommendation of whether or not I should read it and a short description of what I can expect.
Sure. It's not easy, is it?
It's not.
It's really easy. It's just tennis and drugs.
I would probably try to explain the vibes more than anything else. And what David Foster Wallace seems to be concerned about. And then I would add in an enormous disclaimer about how it is genuine work to read this book, and it will be very frustrating at some points.
So basically, the introduction to the episode.
Yeah.
Okay. I think
it'd be irresponsible to say like hand this book to someone and be like, "Trust me, it's going to be great."
No. If someone says, "I like footnotes," be like, "I have the book for you," or I like
enjoy reading
notes.
Terry. Because of his funny footnotes.
Yeah, perfect. Let's see. I forget what I was gonna say. Do you want to? Shall we go into this story? What have you pieced together of the story so far? Keeping in mind that the very first scene in the book, where Hal is freaking out and acting like an animal, but he literally can't talk, is literally the last thing that happens in the narrative.
That's so sad. I'm very curious as to what'll happen to Hal after that. Oh, something I should say that I really like about the writing style is, amidst all the noise, David Foster Wallace is pretty damn good at creating memorable character traits that trigger memories later on, even if you completely, like, you don't know the name of the person or just forgotten. Like, for example, that, I don't remember her name right now, but when she has sex, she spritzes the ceiling with some perfume. And, like, I remember reading that in the weed addict section and thinking, that's a weird thing to do. And then it shows up again in Orin's section. I'm like, oh, I can piece that together. Fantastic. Even though, like, there have been like 20 short stories since then. That's a very genuinely impressive part of his style, I think. Especially considering how hyper detailed things get.
It's impressive how each POV feels very distinct. Like, you can say that about a lot of authors, but I think David Foster Wallace really, really, really does it well. Even in his weird, like, literally my least favorite part of the book is his, what was her name? It was the black lady, and it was all written in AVE. No, whatever. I hate that section. Wardeen. I'm not going to forget about it. I've never forgotten about it. But Hal's sections are obviously Hal. Shtit is Shtit. Orin is Orin, etc.
Mario is Mario.
I love Mario.
I can only assume that Mario gets up to great exploits in the later part of this book.
Oh, just you wait.
Yeah.
But what, you don't think he's heartwarmingly wholesome?
He's very wholesome. He's the most wholesome character in the book right now. And
the only wholesome book in the character. The only wholesome character in the book.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, yeah, like right now he kind of hasn't done anything. He's kind of just been like hapless and existed, and he likes to listen to people and make movies about his brother.
He likes lenses. Nice. He likes movies. He likes his dad.
Cinematography. He's not really good at anything. But
he's really good at listening.
He's really good at listening.
Yeah.
I had a negative bias towards him at the start because I think the first section we have of him is like he's just kind of bothering Hal while Hal is trying to sleep because he can't sleep. And it's like, oh man, I remember being a Hal many times in those situations and just wishing the other person would shut up so I could fall asleep again.
But actually, I know what you're saying, but I really like that section because it points out how comfortable Mario is talking about difficult subjects.
Yeah.
Because they're talking about their mother and then her happiness since their dad killed himself and marrying her half brother or step brother. It's not really clear.
Yeah, I quite like that. I mean, so I've said this to you, but I should say it on air. I like when it comes to the characters in this book, I definitely have a strong preference towards the female ones. I think they're generally just really interestingly written, which makes it a shame that, as you said, this book is like about sons and fathers.
It's very masculine, yeah. And I agree, they're all very interesting. I love Hal. I shouldn't say I love him. I think he's interesting. I think Orin's interesting. I think JOI is really interesting, and I love Mario. And Gately. Plus the Marath and Steeply. I think they're hilarious. But I agree. Kate Gompert was an all-time really, really, really good POV. I love Madame Psychosis or Joelle Van Dyne. Avril, you seem to like her a lot more than I do, but we'll get more of Avril.
And here's the other one. I find her very intriguing. We haven't really gotten much of her so far.
No, we just know she's their mother. She's a little overbearing, but she tries her hardest not to be overbearing.
I think it was
overbearing, she's incredibly overbearing.
Yeah, she's like, whatever you do is fine. I don't expect anything from you. You can fail at everything in life, and I'll love you just the same. And then when they accomplish something, she's like, I'm not proud of you because of this. I'm just generically proud. I think it was a really, really funny and apt thing to do for him to make her a grammatical prescriptivist.
And Canadian. Who might have just married JOI for citizenship. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
And USS Millicent Kent. I love USS Millicent Kent.
That was a funny section with her and Mario.
It was incredibly funny and a little disturbing at the same time. Like they got the camera and she's talking about her father dressing up in her and her sister's and her mother's tiny little clothes and then finding him doing that and just how disturbing that is and how it, like she's much bigger than I am and yet she wants to be a ballerina or like a dancer and that she's in love with Mario, who is a deformed, tiny, green T-Rex armed little boy who needs to have a a police strap to keep him up, and he pushes like a little push broom so he could stand up.
Yeah.
And she tries, I don't know how consensual it was. She's just grabbing him and like he's getting really ticklish. Like she puts his hands in his pants and he's laughing his head off. And I'm like, I don't know how to feel about this, but it's really funny.
I enjoyed that section. I assume Mario would be able to be more vocal if he was really just not enjoying what was going on, but
he was getting tickled though.
He was getting tickled, and I assume that's something that Mario likes. I
assume, knowing Mario, that he enjoyed the experience.
Yeah, I mean he really likes people. He likes interacting with them. He seems to be totally fine speaking his mind, and what his mind is wholesome basically 100% of the time. Yes, a very funny section. It's like she's confessing her undying love for him. He's like, he's the most beautiful person she's ever seen.
Honestly, I
kind of appreciate that because if someone is like Mario, they're probably not hearing that very often.
It doesn't seem to bother him. It seems to bother other people a lot more than it bothers Mario. Like when he was talking with Shtit and some girls make fun of the way Mario looks and he and Shtit go get ice cream and Mario's just enjoying the ice cream.
Yeah, that's true. He's like, it kind of seems impossible to keep him down, you know?
Yeah.
That is something I quite appreciate about him. He's just, you know, he will continue soldiering along, doing the little things that he likes to do, basically no matter how other people are going to treat him.
Any other characters that stood out?
I love Kate Gompert's section. I loved Joelle Van Dyne's section.
She's so great. Like the union of, how was it? Improbably and hideously deformed.
Yeah. And yet she's like unrealistically beautiful. She's just gorgeous.
I think Oren referred to her as the pea goat.
Yeah. Other characters I like, there are character traits I like about other characters. Like, I like you, like, hello, I would like you to commit a crime. Oh, dearie me.
Oh, dearie me, a crime?
Urine,
get your urine
here, yeah,
right out of the tap, little boy urine, like so good. He provides both the drugs and the urine to get past the trust.
Yeah. And Mario helps him out with cleaning the bottles.
Yep.
He just turns out Mario's really good at it,
and he's recording the whole thing.
I love how he just like has this little camera strapped to his head the entire time.
It's a big camera too. Like it's a really big camera for such a like tiny dude who needs a police strap and a broom to get around.
Yeah, like who already is like has an enormous head. Yeah. I mean the way Pamela sells drugs is the funniest part of the book for me so far.
Yeah, it was a good scene.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's it for characters I find interesting. So, I find Hal interesting a lot of the time. I liked Hal's section at the beginning a lot, and I like Flash. Like it's kind of boring to me a lot of his stuff at the moment.
Mm.
A lot of his conversations are good, I think, and he has some good insights.
I think it's interesting how he's like the opposite of Mario, who. Mario is very open and free, and Hal is very not so at all. In fact, he's getting high by himself. He's keeping it a secret, and he has all these problems that he doesn't want to open up to about. He doesn't like opening to open. And when he does talk to Oren, Oren's just listening to him because he wants to sleep with Helen Steeply.
So I do like that part about Hal. He's feeling that there's like kind of no one to talk to, right? Like that, like authentic engagement connection to him, I think seems impossible in the world he lives in. And he doesn't quite know what to do about that.
He actually does go to the library and tell the taxi cab, go to the library and step on it. You don't remember that section?
No.
In the first part, he's has an internal monologue, and he's like, I am intelligent. I have opinions. I'm an interesting person. I'm the type of guy that gets in a taxi and says, to the library and step on it.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And then later in the story, he actually does that, I think, again.
That does sound familiar now.
Because he was talking with Oren about getting books about trauma and trauma therapy and grief therapy.
He wants to be the best at trauma.
Which is funny because, like, in trying to treat the system, he seems to have a real breakthrough.
Yes. What are we talking about?
We're talking about the section where Oren and Hal were talking about finding himself in the microwave. And Hal thought, his first thought was, something smells delicious.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that it did something for him,
mm-hmm.
but there's so much left that he doesn't feel like it's worth talking about. And it's like clearly this did something to him, and he's legitimately traumatized by it. And yeah, like, what is he supposed to, how's he supposed to move past that? He has this conversation with Oren here, but Oren is like kind of paying attention, sure, but at the end it's kind of like, I'm just gonna go.
Or it's just talking to him to get information about how himself killed himself.
Yeah, and like,
Oren's a dick.
It feels like Oren. That sometimes, right? Like you're talking with someone and all they're doing is waiting for their turn to speak next.
That's a common motif in this book, is just people failing to communicate even though they're trying, or
mm-hmm.
talking past each other. Like with Oren and Hal, in both of their conversations, Hal says something, Oren doesn't respond, Oren responds with something that he's interested in, Hal responds with something that he's interested in over and over again.
Yes.
And that going with a prologue / last scene of the book where Hal is actually very intelligent. He memorizes dictionaries, knows all the words, and yet he can't communicate one bit.
Yes.
Or his father literally thinks that he can't speak.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I assume we'll learn more as we go. But it's a genuinely hard thing. Like this is a point where, like, oh yes, the metaphor made real. It's totally something I think that probably is common for people to feel. I certainly feel a lot, like, where it's just like I don't, like, communicating and connecting with people seems pretty difficult. And you say things, you think you're articulating it well, and you're articulating it as best you can, and then someone just completely misunderstands. They totally miss the point. there is no understanding of what's been said, and then conversely, it's hard to understand other people a lot of the time as well. They say things, you don't know why they're saying them, you don't know what the context is, you don't know about the subtext that they're trying to convey. Terrible. It gets me down so much, and it makes forging real connections with people very difficult.
Yep. Well put. Let's see. We talked about characters. Oh, any thoughts about Gately?
The wheelchair assassin guy?
No, that's Marath. Marath is the Quebecois wheelchair assassin, and he's interacting with Hugh Steepley, who is undercover as a very, very large, obviously not woman, and has previously gone undercover as things that are absolutely ridiculous, like going in blackface.
Yeah.
No, Gately is the guy who is responsible for killing the Quebecois separatist terrorist who had a cold.
Right. That was a horrifying section to read.
That was terrible. It's so scary.
Can you imagine?
Like that. I can't think of much things worse than that.
Yeah.
It's written so well, though. Like
that section did not make me predisposed to like Gately at all.
Okay. Well, you notice he is now in the Ennett House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House as an employee. He takes care of everybody else. He becomes a lot more important after this, I'll say that.
Yeah, that makes sense. He also had that part where he and his friends broke into this guy's house and shoved the toothpaste up their ass. Was that?
Yeah, and the DA is after him, and he has a problem with him, and like the DA's wife. It's a whole thing. Gately was He did some bad things. He's really, really bad things.
I'm sure there'll be interesting sections for him. But...
There will be, I promise. Not so far. Although those sections are interesting. It's just he's an ass. Like
he's the worst.
Putting it lightly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I couldn't think of anybody worse actually in the story so far.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been some pretty bad stuff.
Well, the medical attaché is terrible as well.
You mean the guy who died from watching the first guy who died from watching the entertainment Infinite Jest?
Yes.
Mm.
Just kind of like
who's addicted to some Toblerones?
Yeah, Toblerones. The Toblerones for the Saudi ambassador.
The Muslim who's not addicted to any substances, but he is addicted to Toblerones and entertainment.
Yeah, that's fair. I quite like Toblerones as well, but they're too expensive.
I haven't seen one in a while. Let's see. Characters. What? Tell me what you think the story is.
As in, like, what it's trying to achieve, or like where the plot is going.
What do you think is happening?
What I think is happening. It's a good question. I think that probably himself created the Infinite Jest. Maybe that was the thing that he was buried with. I don't know. I think that he created a movie, Infinite Jest, that is kind of like a mind virus that, you know, it's kind of like the ultimate expression of the culture that they live in and like the distilled essence of it. It's something you just can't look away from, and it will just kind of destroy you as you watch it. And, you know, it's like probably something that's like pure spectacle.
Well, we got an idea as what is the Infinite Jest in the Joelle Van Dyne section?
Did she?
She was the actress that was in the movie.
Okay, that was the Infinite Jest. Okay,
yeah, that was the Infinite Jest because it was his final project that he was working on near the end of his life, and she saw him like 100 days before he died, and then he killed himself. Then he was working on the Infinite Jest. I can tell you. Basically, it's her looking into a camera. I forgot what it said. Basically, saying like, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry that I gave you life. I love you and I support you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry." Something.
Oh,
like
just that over and over again.
That's what she said.
Okay.
It's probably a lot more to it because we weren't involved in the editing process. We don't know what JOI was doing, but her part was looking into the camera. And apologizing to the audience.
Have you seen 2001: A Space Odyssey?
Yes, one of my favorite movies.
You know the part where, it's like a psychedelic experience.
Yes, yes.
That's how I picture the Infinite Jest.
Okay.
I can
see that.
What Hal the astronaut was seeing, not necessarily what we the audience are seeing.
I think based on Joelle Van Dyne's section, it's kind of just somebody imagining their mother acknowledging their pain and apologizing for the suffering of life.
I would buy that's part of it. I don't think I would buy that it would be the entire thing.
Yeah, okay.
Because, yeah, it's like the reality is it's probably something that's inexpressible.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. So not like this book at all.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Something that you will read or you will experience for a second and never want to ever stop experiencing it compared to this book that is infinitely frustrating and actually incredibly difficult not to put down.
Yes. Yes. I buy that. So there's this. I imagine that I don't know how I think it's the wheelchair assassin that got it. I don't know how they got it, but I assume they sent it to the Saudi. I don't know why it got into the medical attaché's hands, but I assume that that was probably intentional. Assume that they're trying to spark some kind of diplomatic incident or something with it in order to further their separatist goals.
Okay.
It seems that they're trailing Orin now. I'm not sure why. Maybe this is like a chronological thing. They trail Orin to get the I don't know how they would know that the Infinite Jest even exists. I don't know how I don't know how anyone would know what to do with it without watching it.
You're putting some pieces together, I'll say that. Any thoughts about the Canadian Onan politics?
I'm not sure it makes any sense at all, but the Quebecois do have the history of separatism. Or when was this book written?
95, I don't know.
95. Okay, if I remember correctly, the Quebec separatist movement had ended by that point, but I'm assuming...
I think it took him 10 years. It was published in 1996.
Yeah, because there was a referendum in Quebec, whether they wanted to stay part of Canada or not. And there was pretty massive unrest in the province, because, among other things, they felt like the Anglophone Canadians were, you know, discriminating against them, treating them badly, which was largely true. And there is a lot of genuine prejudice against the Quebecois in Canada. And a lot of it is totally unjustified. It's just because they speak French.
And so well, maybe they should stop speaking French.
Yeah, there's a lot of animosity.
Okay.
And it's a real shame. But so I assume this is where Dave Foster Wallace got that idea from. And as like, yeah, well, in this world, I totally buy that this separatist movement would rise up again.
Especially considering what happened. Do you understand what happened with the Great Concavity / Convexity?
Oh no, this is one of the details that's kind of like washed over me.
Okay, you'll get a an interesting explanation later. It's very quite fun. But what you need to do is that depending on your perspective, there is a Great Concavity / Convexity, where all of the continent's garbage is literally catapulted into. And they mentioned the catapults a few times. Like, it's just like throwing garbage overhead into the Great Concavity Convexity. And that's also where the feral infants, gigantic feral infants and feral hamsters live.
Oh, man. It's such a horrible world.
How could you not love this book? It's so funny.
I liked the part where they fostered, like, this written's like, oh, they invented video calling. And it was really popular, and then it cratered because
people didn't like the way that they looked on camera.
Yeah,
and they didn't like the fact that they couldn't talk to people without looking at them, and they couldn't pretend to pay attention. And
yeah,
which is not true, because I mean we're talking to each other by video, yes. But
and video calls are like very popular,
very very popular. So he was off the mark completely on that, but. I would like to say that he was not off the mark, at least in the way that technology has allowed people, especially on social media, to make themselves look better than they actually are.
Yeah, so he was wrong, but he was also shockingly right about some of it. Like, yeah. Okay, so people like is saying, okay, they put these filters on, they were enormously expensive, they made them look beautiful. And then to save money, people will just kind of like have stills. Like still photos displayed on the screen instead. And then there was like, you know, people essentially complaining of like catfishing or whatnot. Cause yeah. Oh, you look so much better online. I, as far as I understand that is true in the
and some people just got so anxious about it. They wouldn't leave their house and they would always wear a mask everywhere they went.
Yeah. And that okay. So filters are free, which I think is terrible. And there's a lot of, you know, I've never been part of this culture, but like the Facetune app, I think is one of the big ones. I don't know. Yeah, like a lot of people are getting very insecure about their appearances and feel like they can't display their, you know, like they need to put things through filters, and this gets reinforced when you look online and everyone else is doing the same, and it's just like a very bad negative feedback loop. Good job, David Foster Wallace, for almost completely capturing that.
So any thoughts about the corporate dystopia that ONAN has turned into?
Oh, it seems like a complete hellscape. Yeah. there's corporate subsidized years now.
The year of GLAAD, the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken, YDAU, which is the year of the dependent adult undergarment.
There's a really long one too.
Yeah, the you shih tzu something 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 something. That one's my favorite. Oh, it's actually pronounced you shit you, which is funny, even though that's not like a real Japanese thing. But the year of the American dairy products from the American heartland. I like that one.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, besides that, it's like it seems like a like this book does not feel like it's trying to comment on politics, really.
Not
kind of
really,
like
no.
Using them as a, but
not, yeah, not in realistic politics, at least, other than I guess the Quebecois separatist movements.
Yeah, like something that draws upon.
You'll learn more about the president of Onan soon. He's an interesting guy.
Okay.
Let's see, we haven't talked about it because it's, I don't know, but it's a really, really, really important part of the book is addiction.
Yes.
The Infinite Jest itself is an addiction that people can't give up, literally, mm-hmm. and they die doing it. Almost everybody in the book is addicted to something, whether it be Toblerones or weed or secrecy, various drugs. I don't know. I'm not an addict, but it felt real. And I think some of the best sections are the long descriptions of the anxiety that comes along with addiction and the worry about addiction and some of the trips, especially Joel Van Dyne's was very, what's the word? Yeah, I can't remember it.
Yeah, I have very mixed feelings on these sections. Not because I think they're poorly written or not worth what they are. I just have a hard time connecting to them a lot of the time. Except in the situations where, like, you really get to the heart of why they're addicted. You know, like, basically because they can't cope with life.
Mm-hmm.
And those bits I do enjoy. But there's a lot of surrounding stuff around that that is kind of foreign to me. I also don't have an addiction.
I can't think of, like, especially reading stuff like this or watching movies about addiction or reading other stuff about addiction. It's just something in my life that I've always tried my absolute hardest not to get involved with.
Yeah.
Just because it seems terrifying. And, like, I understand why people would be, you know, fall into that. But it's just something that I've put a lot of effort into not.
I mean, one time I was in the hospital and they gave me one of the really good painkillers, Dilaudid. And when I took that, I was like, ah, I can absolutely understand why people are addicted to this.
I remember my dad, he had some really good painkillers after his surgery. And when he was coming down from them, it was scary. Because he got addicted, he was on them for too long. Mm. And once he realized that, he's like, he was trying to wean himself off. He's like, I'm having withdrawal symptoms. This is like the worst feeling I've ever had in my life. Like, he went to the doctor the next day. They talked about getting him off on a better plan or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, withdrawal symptoms absolutely suck. I say this from perspective of I've in the past gone into withdrawal quite a few times over antidepressants, which are they're definitely not the worst thing to be suffering from withdrawal from.
Not alcohol.
They're not pleasant at all, and especially since like I went cold turkey on them from pretty high doses. So they do this among other things. They there's this symptom called brain zaps where it's just kind of like it just feels like someone is shocking your brain, and then it's like, oh, and that'll just happen throughout the day. And wow. Suffice it to say, I was much worse at my job while I was going through withdrawal.
We're only a fourth way in, but there's a couple of sections of this book about addiction stories that I don't think I'll ever forget in my life. It'll stick with you. It's really, really, really messed up stuff that's incredibly well written, but not something you want to experience again. I'm curious to your thoughts when we get to them.
Yeah. Did I violate the... Did I not? Damn it. There was the section on what you can learn from addiction.
Oh, that's a really good section.
I pasted one part that I really liked from it in the chat. Let's see if I can. Oh, you pasted it actually.
Yeah.
Not the part that I was thinking of. That's okay. Yeah, there's a lot of like parts that I quite like in this book, and I was like, oh, Dave Foster Wallace, you're genuinely insightful here, and I think it's something that needs to be pointed out. Like one of the things that the addiction section says, right? One of the things you learn is that it is simply more pleasant to be happy than to be pissed off.
It's right.
Which is something that seems obvious, but which I think almost everybody these days has a tough time actually internalizing, myself included. Yeah, it's just better. It's just like, if I'm doing something that's just going to make me pissed off, why am I doing that? Why don't I stop doing that? Why don't I do something that makes me happy instead?
Which reminds me, there also is quite a bit of, what's it called when you overanalyze something and you just get frozen because of it?
Analysis paralysis.
Analysis paralysis. That's a common motif in this book as well.
Yeah. It seems common with Hal.
Hal, also Ur-Daddy, because Ur-Daddy at one point where, at the weed smoking section where he gets a call and somebody knocks on the door at the same time and he literally freezes and he doesn't know what to do. It's like a metaphor.
How can you do anything? Yeah. Right. I quite liked the section with Kate Gompert. I'll read a couple quotes that, as someone who struggled with these. Yeah, I really liked that part. As someone who struggled with these issues before quite a bit, I thought like, okay, yes, David Foster Wallace, you get it. There's a lot of people who talk about suicide in ways that I don't find very compelling, and I feel like they don't really get it. But David Foster Wallace clearly gets it. Kate Gompert says...
because he was suffering as well.
Yeah, probably. I didn't want to especially hurt myself or, like, punish. I don't hate myself. I just wanted out. I didn't want to play anymore is all. By the way, I think I thought those... I didn't want to play anymore. I've thought those exact thoughts. Play, nodding in confirmation, making small quick notes. I just wanted to stop being conscious. I'm a whole different type. I wanted to stop feeling this way. If I could have put myself in a really long coma, I would have done that. Or given myself shock, I would have done that instead. Again, like, I have thought those exact thoughts in dark times. The doctor was writing with great industry. The last thing more I'd want is hurt. I just didn't want to feel this way anymore. I didn't believe this feeling would ever go away. I don't. I still don't. I'd rather feel nothing than this. yes, like no notes. This is what it's like, which is, yeah.
That's why we read.
That's why we read.
Thank you for sure.
And then as something that I've independently learned and which has actually helped me a lot, like most clinically depressed patients, she appeared to function better in focused activity than in stasis. Their normal paralyzed stasis allowed these patients' own minds to chew them apart. So that is, I keep myself very busy for these exact reasons. Because when I have a day off and I'm doing nothing, I will spiral into terrible thoughts and feel terrible. So I keep myself incredibly busy, because when I'm incredibly busy, then I can, my mind doesn't have that leeway to work upon itself.
Yeah. I think it's good just to keep busy anyway.
I agree. Yeah. It being productive does feel nice as well.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Also just kind of exercise, you know,
mm-hmm.
What really sucks about that section is that, the doctors are kind of useless, but because they have to be, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're in this professional setting. They have to treat everything that she's saying with a clinical detached manner. And it's probably not best for her, but it's just so sad.
The doctor was anxious that his failure to have any idea what the girl was referring to would betray itself and accentuate her feelings of loneliness and psychic pain. Classic unipolars were usually tormented by the conviction that no one else could hear or understand them when they tried to communicate. Hence jokes, sarcasm, the psychopathology of unconscious arm rubbing. Like, the doctor is, like, he's just trying to project the right expressions to display back at her while she talks. And
what would you label this as?
Yeah, exactly. And in his behavior, he's acting in exactly the way that someone who's depressed and feels like no one's going to understand worries that people will be acting. He doesn't understand. She's saying things and they're flying completely over his head. And there's like, it seems there's no real common ground. She is alone, even though she's in this room with him.
It's like I said, common motifs.
Yep.
That reminds me of that part in the AA wisdom section where it says that no single moment in and of itself is unendurable.
Oh, yes. That was actually the one I was thinking of earlier. Yes.
Good one.
That's a very good one.
Let's see. I think we've talked about a lot of stuff, gone over a lot of the common themes. Fame is an important one,
mm-hmm.
especially in regards to sports and tennis and football.
I've noticed that the addicts well, the ones who are really struggling, have this pattern of
kicking. Everyone's the habit. An addict, right?
Everyone's an addict, yeah.
It's just like the difference is their classes, right? All the high class students over at the tennis academy, they're all addicts anyway, but you know, they're rich and they can deal with it. And then we got the low Boston trashy people at the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. All the house. Although at the Innit House Drug and Alcohol Recovery House, they're both type of people there too. Because we got that really annoying lawyer. I forgot his name.
Oh, he's like, I'm not refusing that I have a problem. I need you to define what the problem is.
So I'm not going to agree to anything unless you. Yeah. Like, dude, you're just going to admit you had a problem. That was
a really good section as well. Actually, just patients talking about their problems. Basically, I think that was really well done. Yeah. One of the really funny jokes I actually quite liked in this is the minimal mambo.
It basically just looks like people standing still.
Another large, loose group is dancing in the cleared space between the cluster of directorial chairs and the bedroom door, most favoring YDAU's minimal mambo, this autumn's East Coast anti-craze. The dancers appearing to be just this side of standing still, the subtlest possible hints of fingers snapping under right-angled elbows. And then one of them is doing like something subversive or like particularly well, and there's just like the tiniest like finger snaps.
Like this book is so funny. Like there's so many jokes, and I'm sure I'm missing a lot of them too, but just the ones that I'm getting are just so funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like even things that aren't exactly jokes, like they're still funny, like the feral infants or JOI's dad's obsession with Marlon Brando, or what was it? Hal had an essay about the classic hero from Hawaii Five-O versus the postmodern hero of the Hill Street Blues.
That's something I highlighted as well. His teacher's feedback: a submission receiving just a B plus, despite overall positive feedback, mostly because its concluding part was neither set up by the essay's body nor supported, Ogilvy pointed out, by anything more than subjective intuition and rhetorical flourish. That is something like I don't know if that's how Infinite Jest is going to turn out to be, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, they said, I think in that same essay, that they're waiting for somebody to be a kind of hero of non-action. So.
Yeah, which kind of to me brought to mind like Taoism, and specifically one of Ursula Le Guin's books, the Lathe of Heaven, where like the hero, the protagonist is heroic because he doesn't do things, because he refuses to act upon the world, even though he can.
Neutral gene.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I guess the distinction here would be Hal's hero would be unable to affect the world anyways.
Yeah.
So.
But affecting yourself is affecting the world, right?
I agree. Yes, I think this is something that all too often gets lost. A great way to change the world is to change yourself.
There's a really good story that's only thematically involved, is the guy who injured himself in the ladders and the bricks, and how he would fall down the ladder, the bricks would go to the top of the building, and the pallet would break, the bricks would fall down, he would fall, the bricks would hit him on the way down, and he would go all the way up and hit his head and break his arms and break his legs, and it's so well described, and it's so horrifying and yet incredibly hilarious.
Yes. Like the most, like the ultimate slapstick.
Yeah. I remember you of Erickson, actually.
Yeah.
Oren complaining about having to dress up as an Arizona Cardinal was also very funny.
Or like the wingsuit gliding over like a football game or something.
They're coming into the football game dressed up as birds and in wingsuits, and he's complaining about it. He's like, I'm a kicker. I just kick things. And he's like, just be thankful you're not a Brown. What's a Brown? I want to know what a Brown is.
I think we can. I think we can guess.
Maybe.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, it was just, a couple things. Himself in his, you know, conversation with Hal, pretending to be a professional conversationalist, He's only found out because he's in full costume and he's committing to the bit completely. He's only mm-hmm. found out by Hal because he's dressed up in his trademark sweater vest. He put all of this effort into looking different, but he still wears the same sweater vest he wears all the time. And
it's like horribly stained and he never washes.
Did you catch he's an alcoholic too? Was, I should say.
Maybe. It's possible I did. There's really no way of knowing.
Last one, just a funny section I wanted to talk about was early in the book, Shtit is described by many of the students as a Nazi and as a fascist. And during, you know, Hal's whole conversation with Oren talking about finding himself in the oven and blown up head, he says, but the first authority figure I ran into was Shtit, who is irreproachably brisk and efficient and sensible at everything and turned out to be just the authority figure to go get to in the first place. Which is kind of scary, but funny.
Yeah. It is. The Tennis Academy, just like the whole organization, is very funny. Like the curriculum that they have. I don't remember any of the courses.
Hyper focused on English grammar and lenses and entertainment.
Honestly, there are worse high school curriculums out there, so
probably. it's also like really, really hard. Like that's what I got out of it. Like yeah. Not only do these kids have to like push themselves to the limit learning tennis and being the best tennis players that they could be, hopefully entering the game, but they also have an incredibly difficult curriculum. Oh, and then the we get like insights to the people at the Innet House and they're complaining about all of like the hoity-toity high class kids up on the hill. And we actually see all the high class kids in the hill are just miserable.
Yeah. There's that section where there's like the young kid in the academy and everyone is bitching about how horrible practice is and how busy their lives are. And then Hal's just like, yeah, I mean, this is it, kid. if you make it to the show, it'll be more of this. Yeah. But hey, you got to bitch about it with people, which is, I guess, great.
Should we go to listener questions or do you have anything else you want to bring up?
In this section where Hal is talking to Oren, the phone call, the second phone call, I quite liked this part by Hal. But you never know when the magic will descend on you. You never know when the grooves will open up. And once the magic descends, you don't want to change even the smallest detail. You don't know what the concordance of factors and variables yields that calibrated can't miss feeling. And you don't want to soil the magic by trying to figure it out. But you don't want to change your grip, your stick, your side of the court, your angle of incidence to the sun, your heart in your throat every time you change sides of the court. And, you know, sometimes life just kind of feels magical, right? I think this captures very well of, just, you know, sometimes there's like a little bit of a shifting and then suddenly things look beautiful and great and they seem to be working out. And then inevitably gets ruined when you notice this and you're like, oh, I don't want this to change ever. You know, I want to play forever. I want things to be as beautiful and perfect as they are now. And then, boom, it falls apart.
Yep.
But yeah, listener questions.
All right. Sun Gamer says, what are the metaphors? I think we've talked about quite a few. Another one is tennis being a metaphor for life.
Yep.
And that I think Gerhardt and Mars talking to Mario about it, and that you are a single individual and you are battling against somebody else. And whether that be an addiction or any other problems in your life, it's only you and the problem. Mm-hmm. It only will ever be you the problem. And especially at the academy, we have all of these tennis players and they're a group of tennis players, but they're all playing their own game and they're competing against each other. Because they have to compete against each other, and their teachers and their parents are pitting them against each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's a metaphor. What's another metaphor?
It's another metaphor.
The entertainment Infinite Jest is a metaphor for addiction.
And like the cultural malaise, I would say. You know, it's like an expression of like, okay, well, like everyone is, well, not everyone. It's certainly been talked about plenty that, you know, there's a crisis of meaning and people are feeling isolated, alone, like, there is no purpose, that nothing that they do matters. And I think the Infinite Jest is it's a metaphor for the kind of culture that produces that mentality and those problems.
What do the feral infants, what are they metaphors for?
antinatalist mentalities.
Well, I think it's they are a side product of all of the garbage and trash and pollution that's going on, and the children are always the first to suffer in those kind of situations. So I think they represent the youth of our future.
That's just fair.
Mindlessly wandering about the wilderness, not knowing what to do because we failed them.
Yeah.
I just made that up, but it sounds smart.
I mean, you won't find me arguing that we're failing today's youth.
that we're not
failing.
I'm not going to bring it up for fear that it will move you somewhere. There are so many missing details, like from just like the first two chapters, of lots of little clues of like who did what and what's their motivation for something. Actually, I think when you finish the book, it would be really helpful to go back and reread the first chapter.
Yeah. Yeah, I buy that.
Let's see what else. Did you have any more metaphors?
It's not exactly a metaphor, but the drugs people are taking are all clearly set to deal with specific problems that they're having, right? And the way they get addicted to it, it reflects the deeper problems they have, you know, and what they're trying to get away from.
We have one more question.
Yeah, go for it.
Tura. Tura says, why was this not the right book for me to read, poolside in Crete?
Because presumably, if you're in Crete, you want to be doing things. And I feel like this is a good book for when you're not wanting to do things.
I think this is a good book for when you hate yourself and you want to read something that, you know, you want to punish yourself.
Yeah, you want to read something that hates you back.
Yeah. You just weren't in the mood for a book that hates you.
I wouldn't read this book on vacation,
I don't think. I would, but I love this book.
Would you read it the first time on vacation?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I think this is an excellent book. I think it'd be a great book to read in like casual settings, like outside or at bookstores at a library or in a cafe. I think I would really enjoy that. But you know, if you're on a vacation, you're in a different mindset.
Yep, I agree. When you want to relax, when you have fun, and you want to get away from life, this is not a good book for that.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's a good point. I think when you're in the middle of life, this is a good book.
It's the hardcover.
Yeah, it looks nice.
So, what are you looking forward to? What are you anticipating?
I'm looking forward to Joelle Van Dyne coming back and taking over the entire plot.
Didn't she die?
Just every section being.
I thought she died from overdose.
Did she die?
No, she didn't.
Yeah.
I love Mario's infatuation with her. So cute.
He just likes listening about Madame Psychosis. Just talk.
W-Y-Y-Y.
I do really like Madame. Like, I think if Madame Psychosis had a radio, like a podcast, she would be very popular.
I might be overlooking this a bit, but I think Madame Psychosis is a nod to Ulysses.
How so?
All right. So in the first chapter with Leopold and his wife, Molly, she's reading a book, and Leopold is kind of intellectual. He likes to, and she asked him, what is metempsychosis? And he says, metempsychosis. And he gives her some big fancy definition. And she says, just tell me what he's like every day. Yeah. It's a great section of Ulysses, but I don't know. I think it might be an odd Ulysses.
Yeah. I buy that.
I think David Foster Wallace was inspired by James Joyce.
Yes. And it's the kind of inspiration where it's like, he's not, I think he's willing to tip his hat, but he's definitely created something very distinct.
Oh, yeah.
Which is sometimes the case for inspirations, and sometimes it's like, oh.
I think I told you this before. But this is often considered a part of an unofficial, obviously an unofficial modernism trilogy, where Ulysses is the modern postmodernist first book. Gravity's Rainbow is the postmodern middle book, and this is the metamodern final book in the trilogy.
This is metamodern.
This book basically got people talking about metamodernism and
interesting. Okay,
and the new sincerity.
I can see that.
Yes. And they're both gigantic tomes that are very difficult to read.
Have you read Gravity's Rainbow?
I have. I was not ready for it. I need to read it again. I will never, ever, ever, ever forget one section from it. And I'm not looking forward to reading it again, but I definitely will read it again. So anything else?
I think that's it. All yeah, right. Despite everything, I wouldn't say I'm like looking forward to getting back to this book now, but I'm looking forward to having finished this book and getting to look back on it.
That's a interesting way of putting it.
Yeah.
I think we're vibing pretty well, actually. I mean, obviously I'm a huge fan of this book, but like I remember my first time. I think you'll be a fan by the end.
Yeah, like I'm looking forward to having finished, I'm not saying like, oh, I'm looking forward to having it on a shelf and never thinking about it again. I enjoy thinking about this book and I enjoy talking about it.
There's a lot to think and talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is undeniable.
Yeah, it's like the pure process of reading it is the it's the hard part.
It gets easier. I think at the beginning he's really kind of training you. And like an annoying friend, they kind of grow on you and you get used to it.
I can buy that. Yeah.
All right. So that has been our discussion on the first fourth of David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest. If you liked what you listened to, thanks. Come to the Discord and talk to us about it. If you didn't, I'm sorry. We're just kind of two guys and we're not very bright. At least I'm not. Please forgive us and tell us how we're stupid and wrong on the Discord. I'd like to thank all the people involved in the Legendarium and say thank you. And yes, That's been me. I'm Huron Fan and this is Ash.
Bye. It is. Bye.
What's something notoriously long and difficult book, Infinite Jest? Notoriously frustrating? I don't know.
Yeah. Notoriously pretentious.
Oh, boo.
I wouldn't call it pretentious, but I'm reluctant to call most things pretentious that people seem to think weren't the term.
The whole book's a joke, though.
Like, yes, it's a very self-indulgent joke.
Masturbatory, might you say?
Yes. I would absolutely describe it as masturbatory.